CBSI in the World. I'm John Batchelor. Ukraine conflict. The options ahead in this, the second year of war, springtime. I welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army, retired, CBS News, visiting professor Dickinson College, as well as the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. Jeff, I'm following the reporting from the Institute of the Study of War. Three options put on the table, surprising no one. One option for Ukraine, for Kyiv, is to offer surrender terms that look like a negotiation, something like Minsk II from 2015. The Donbass is an independent agent. The Russian forces maintain security along the frontier. There's supervision in some fashion, and Ukraine begins the rebuild of the part of the country left to it with a Marshall Plan scale from the European Union and the United States. That's one option. Your response to that option, Jeff?
Well, good morning, John. And, you know, Freda Clay wrote a famous book about war's ending. And in that book, Clay, I think, clearly laid out wars come to an end when one side or the other changes their goals. And it seems to me in this case, neither side has changed their goals. In fact, their goals have in many ways hardened. If you look at it from the perspective of Zelensky, you know, a recent independent poll suggested that 74% of all Ukrainians said we should pursue this war until we recover all our territory, even that lost in 2014. And 97% were convinced that Ukraine was going to win. Now, that just may be bellicosity or over-optimism, but that is the attitude. So it seems to me from Mr. Zelensky's position, if nothing else, to now negotiate with the Russians would be political suicide for him. On the other side of the equation, of course, is Mr. Putin. And it may be the same for him at this particular point. This war may have become existential for his position in power. But I think he certainly believes that he can prolong this war indefinitely based on perhaps limitless manpower, move it to a frozen conflict like he has had in many ways in Transnistria, in Moldova, in Georgia, between Armenia and Azerbaijan over Nagorno-Karabakh, as he had in Ukraine following the invasion of 2014. Believing that, in fact, his willpower is longer than the West. But in any event, I think for the Ukrainians, this would be foolhardy, as they now are talking about the arrival of, in the last few days, 14 UK Challengers, arriving Leo 2s, 90 Strikers, 40 Martyrs, recovery vehicles, assault bridging, all that equipment promised by the West is starting to arrive. And furthermore, one could argue NATO is getting stronger. It appears now almost without question that Finland will join NATO. The Hungarian parliament has approved it. Turkey likely will. And then we'll have to see about Sweden. So the negotiating right now from the Ukrainian position seems to be, I think, not the best thing for them to do.
The second option, which is what it appears to be now, a slugfest between artillery, sometimes extremely accurate because of drone technology and because of the HIMARS, and resembling a baby Verdun of 1916. As long as you stay in your revetments and depots, the artillery contest is not big casualties. It is positional artillery. The longer the range, the more effective you are. The only casualty rate would climb when you launch an offensive, such as the Russians have been launching recently. But a stalemate along the frontier with both sides needing to supply ammo and manpower and the will to sustain it with their allies. What do you make of that option, Jeff?
One talks about this, it would be to what end? An artillery duel, a frozen conflict like World War I, 1916, to what end? And the only end would be one side or the other, as the Germans saw it when they launched the offensive, we can bleed the other side white. They will therefore sue for peace. And both sides have suffered enormous casualties just in this area of Bakhmut. There are estimates, John, that the Wagner force that at one time had 50,000 troops, over 30,000 are now dead, wounded, missing, deserted. Russia overall estimates over 200,000 casualties. And clearly, the Ukrainians have taken massive casualties as well. So unless one buys the argument that I can bleed my opponent white and they will then eventually give up, it doesn't seem to me this is a means to what particular ends. But the Ukrainians certainly know this doesn't lend itself well to them because they know full well that support in the West is not endless. It won't go on forever. they are worried about many of the voices in Europe. Mr. Macron has been outspoken in France about a negotiation. And they're also worried about 2024 in the United States, with comments by former President Trump and Mr. DeSantis, a likely candidate, that says this is not in U.S. interest. So, and then finally, of course, can we generate artillery ammo for such an endless artillery struggle? There have been encouraging signs, the EU effort now to work together to produce up to 1 million rounds. Recent reports that Bulgaria may, in fact, transfer through the EU a substantial amount of former Soviet artillery and tank ammo, small arms ammo, which would be very useful for the Ukrainians. But still, supply will be a major concern if the Ukrainians want to end up in an endless artillery slugfest with the Russians.
A detail about a slugfest, because you are an artillery man. What is the cost of morale and exhaustion on artillery teams that answer round for round and have orders coming in all the time, move to this target, move to that target? Does it wear down? Is there a timeline on that, Jeff?
I can't put an exact timeline, but it certainly does wear down the crews, because one thing you have to do, particularly on a battlefield like this, which did not occur in World War One, is you have to move your positions frequently. In World War One, you could pretty much stay in one position as the infantry line stagnated and you could pound away from where you were. Now, because of drones, because of counter battery radars and our ability to acquire where rounds are coming from, you got to shoot and scoot. You have to shoot and then reposition your artillery piece, because incoming fire could come back at you almost as quickly as the rounds you just expended.
One technology question. The arsenal of democracy contains weapons that have not, we're told, entirely been deployed into Ukraine. Are there weapon systems that would change this artillery duel to a Ukrainian advantage without risking an offensive?
Yeah, I think possibly if you were to provide the Ukrainians longer range systems like the ATACMS missile or longer range HIMARS. The HIMARS we gave them has a range that's limited beyond its max range. Doing that, we might allow the Ukrainians to better interrupt Russian resupply lines, because the one thing you want to do in that kind of a contest is degrade your opponent's ability to fire back. You do that through counter battery fire, of course. You do that as well by interrupting his ability to resupply his forces along the battlefield.
So there are weapons that would damage or reverse the Russian ability to fire into the Ukrainian positions. We possess those weapons, and the Ukrainians have them or not yet?
They do not have them as yet, John. They do not have the ATACMS. They do not have the maximum range HIMARS rocket that we have in our arsenal. And of course, the acquisition of aircraft, which they wish to receive, also could contribute to that kind of counter battery activity.
And missiles, they do not have long-range missiles. I'm looking at striking at Rostov-on-Don that far deep in, because you want to cut the supply lines, the logistics. They don't have that yet also. Is that correct, Jeff?
They have some missiles, John. We saw them use a longer-range missile, an anti-ship missile, for example, when they sunk the Moskva. But exactly how many they have, how much range they have, that to me is unclear, where they could sustain an effort to hit deeper into the Donbas region occupied by Russia, or even Russia proper, to interrupt those Russian supply lines.
Now the third option, which is Ukraine mounts a series of counteroffensives, one or more of which is aimed at Crimea. We talked about this last time when I puzzled about riverine boats. That's John Kerry territory. What do you need a riverine boat for if you're dug in? You do if you're going to cross rivers like the Dnieper and the rivers in Crimea. There's also the question of bridging equipment. So, an offensive, Jeff. You've participated in a big offensive. You need a lot of everything, not on the first day, but on the 50th day. Does Ukraine have that yet?
It appears they're certainly getting that, John, as I mentioned a little while ago. Now we're seeing the arrival of tanks. Now we're seeing the arrival of the Martyr. Now we're seeing the arrival of the Stryker. We're seeing the arrival of the Bradley. We're seeing the arrival of the assault bridging. We're seeing arrival of major recovery vehicles that can recover tanks if they're damaged or need repair. All those things are arriving. In addition to them arriving, John, they're arriving with trained Ukrainian crews, because the Ukrainians have been training on these systems in Germany and elsewhere. We also have Ukrainian battalions returning who have gone through combined arms training back in some of our training areas in Germany, and therefore are better prepared to conduct this kind of an offensive military operation.
The counteroffensive also would involve casualty climbing, any offensive operation. I just read the books, Jeff. three times or more the manpower necessary against a defending force. Also, looking at what attacking Crimea would look like, the best analogy I can come up with right now, given the victory that the Wehrmacht enjoyed in 1940 when it launched on the Belgian, French, and British troops massed in the north of France, leading to Dunkirk and the catastrophe of that retreat. But the German casualties were not slight. In the first day, there was surprise, but the British and the Belgians fought very carefully in their retreat. The French had some first units that engaged, and the frontline panzer units and the frontline infantry suffered casualty rates that were very high. The estimates can be vague because it was propaganda, but somewhere between 12 and 30% in the frontline troops, those engaging with the enemy. Now, is Ukraine in a position to sustain that scale of casualties and keep the war going?
Well, the question becomes, of course, time and place, John. And what you want to do, of course, is retrieve a penetration and then exploit that penetration by the mass movement of heavy armor. That's why things like this bridging is so important, not only from the shock action of the tanks, but to keep that moving. And the faster you can move, the faster you can roll up the enemy. This reduces, obviously, your casualty levels. And one thing the Ukrainians think they're doing, at least, or they're reported to be doing, is bleeding the Russian forces in those areas where they're likely to conduct major offensive. Most likely, people are pointing towards Zaporizhia province, moving towards Melitopol in an effort to, if you will, divide this land bridge Russia has between Russia proper and Crimea. But, you know, those successful operations you pointed out in the past, John, usually came at a time and a place that surprised the adversary to a degree. We know the French expected the attack was going to come against the Maginot Line. The Germans went around it. We know the Iraqis expected us to attack directly into Kuwait. We went around it. We saw last fall the Ukrainians doing what isn't called in Russian doctrine, maskarovka, deception on where the main attack is coming, going to be. And so they've talked incessantly about this attack, and every expectation is it will be towards Melitopol, but there is a possibility of some plan of maskarovka, deception, and then being able to envelop, moving swiftly, which would reduce those particular casualty levels that you rightfully point out can certainly occur if you attack headlong into enemy defenses.
And those casualties climb in a victorious campaign. That's why I'm using Dunkirk from the German point of view. That is seen now by history as enormously successful, so much so that always the debate, why did they pause? I understand. I don't want to engage that. I just want to say when you're winning, the casualties climb, and that is a drain on everybody's resources. The Ukrainians are not entirely, well, even partially at this point, a professional army. These are volunteers. These are very brave people. However, Jeff, into a campaign like that into Crimea, and the reason I pick out Crimea is they're trapped there, Jeff. They can bug out to Rostov-on-Don, but if the Crimea is attacked, they have nothing but the Black Sea behind them. So it would be Dunkirk-like. Can Ukraine sustain that? What do we need to know to answer yes or no on that, Jeff, in the coming months?
I think we need to know, frankly, more details about what casualties they've sustained so far. The Ukrainians have been very close-fisted about releasing any information about their own casualties. Now, there are reports in Bakhmut they have primarily used territorial forces while keeping their most professional units in the reserve to conduct this upcoming offensive. And they've been pretty outspoken about that. But how much they've been able to do that while at the same time reports of reinforcing Bakhmut is unclear. But you know, John, it doesn't always work out that way. It's what we prepared to invade Iraq back in 1991. And I was part of the lead attack force. And my armored cavalry commander came and saw me and told me that the prediction was that we would suffer 80% casualties. Well, we suffered a handful because we penetrated the Iraqi positions and then rolled them up rapidly. I'm not predicting that necessarily because terrain is very different, as you rightfully point out, in Crimea than the desert of Iraq and Saudi Arabia. But there are cases in history where offensive military operations have succeeded far beyond their expectations. And my guess is, rather than trying to take Crimea by some headlong assault, the idea would be, first of all, to divide that land bridge to Russia, take out the Kerch Bridge, and then it basically becomes a big siege, John, as the Russians are stuck trying to figure out a way to resupply that force now surrounded, or figure out a way to evacuate them by sea.
Or call Churchill. Yes, I understand. Jeff McCausland, United States Army, retired, CBS News, Dickinson College, Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. When we come back, Putin is talking about tactical nukes. What is the result of that Putin-Xi meeting? What does it mean for NATO? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.